Professor Samira Kawash of Rutgers University has written a book called Candy, A Century of Panic and Pleasure, in which she recounts the story of how candy evolved from a luxury to a cheap everyday snack. Candy really, according to Samira, led the way in the development of processed foods, many of which we label junk food today. Candy is still with us in a very big way and still has its reputation as a guilty pleasure. Professor Kawash, known as the Candy Professor, joins us now on the phone from New York. Professor Samira Kawash, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be with you over remote wires.
Yes, exactly. Well, you're lucky you're not here, actually. This wind is howling pretty hard, and the snow is blowing around, so maybe it's better where you are in Brooklyn.
I hope your listeners are warm inside, huddled around the radio.
Oh, they are. Everybody here knows how to stay warm. You've written what I call a very intensely researched and scholarly work, really, on the history of candy and the food industry in general over the past 100 years. How did you come to undertake such a huge project?
Well, it's so funny to put the words scholarly and candy right up next to each other, isn't it? I mean, they seem like polar opposites. And certainly that was, you know, when I first started, I didn't expect to find the wealth of cultural and social and medical and nutritional history that I ended up dredging up around the topic of candy. You know, when I started, it was really as a kind of candy eater slash candy panicker. You know, I had a little daughter. She was about 3 years old, and oh boy, she liked those jelly beans. But I wasn't really sure, you know, with little kids especially, candy kind of seems maybe like not something they should be eating. And I noticed with my friends also, with the little, you know, preschoolers, there was a lot of anxiety around candy. And I started wondering about it because it seems to me that, you know, we give our kids apple juice, we give them Teddy Grahams, we give them popsicles, and we don't worry. But then the candy comes out and it's like, oh no, that's going to spoil the dinner, that's going to give cavities, that might make them fat. You know, there's a lot of worries about sort of the toxins in the candy. And I was just really struck by how we kind of put candy in a category by itself as uniquely harmful. And I wanted to understand what that was about and really where those fears came from.
And whether they're real or not real.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as with all of our food, you know, there's a lot of sifting and sorting to be done. And I think that with candy in particular, the magnitude of the fears seems to take little small things and kind of blow them into really big things. And I think sometimes there's a little kernel of truth. I mean, you know, obviously sure. We shouldn't be eating candy all the time. It's not a substitute for food. But there's a long way from, you know, from that fear to just, you know, the little bit of candy that by itself is not actually that harmful.
Well, you uncovered some really interesting stories about things people have said about candy over the years. We'll get to those in a minute. It was interesting to me that you found that when you looked at histories of food historians speaking about American diet and so on, they didn't even mention candy.
Well, that was so striking to me when I began this research. I mean, I'm a scholar, so I go to the books and I look in the index, and candy is just not there. And it was especially surprising because, you know, candy was really one of the first big food processing industries, and candy was kind of the first major manufactured snack that Americans consumed. And by the 1920s, Americans are consuming like 15 to 20 pounds of candy per year. So it was not insubstantial, the amount of candy that was being eaten, even early in the 20th century. And yet, you know, the whole food history story of America and the transformation from a rural agrarian diet to a processed food diet in the 20th century, it just left candy out. And this was stunning to me because it was obvious when you looked at how much candy was there that it had to be part of the story.
Sure. And it was interesting to me to learn how candy, as we know it, is really a relatively recent phenomenon since the 19th century, really. Could you give us just a brief sketch of how it evolved and came about from a kind of a luxury food to something that everybody can afford?
Well, this was especially true in America, in the United States, where we did not have, in the 19th century, a very robust access to sugar supplies. And so sugar, up until after the Civil War, sugar was very expensive. And the other thing is that candy, before the advent of machines, candy is laborious. It's difficult to make. If you've ever tried making candy, it's a tricky thing. It's not something that you can just pick up casually. So it took special skill, it took a lot of labor, and it took an expensive prime ingredient, that is sugar. And as a consequence, it was a luxury good. There was not a lot of it, and most of the good candy was imported and therefore very expensive. It really wasn't until the 1880s, once things had settled down after the Civil War, that the increase in the sugar supply and the lower prices due to the introduction of steam machinery really transformed candy into something that could be manufactured quickly and at a much lower price. So all of a sudden you have this explosion of low price, you know, we call penny candies, for example, the licorices and the little balls and the chewy things, in addition to a wider array of all kinds of candies that are available to, you know, grown-ups and children alike in a way that had never before been possible. So really, you know, you look at the 1880s and 1890s and there's an explosion in the amount of candy that's out there to be eaten. And the increase in the amount of candy to be eaten, well, somebody has to eat it. So the candy manufacturers were really faced with the challenge of convincing Americans that candy was something they should be eating much more than they had been used to eating it in the past.
Well, even you talked early in the book about when it first came on the market. First of all, most people couldn't afford it before this, and they were also sort of malnourished. A lot of people or undernourished, and this was seen as maybe a cheap way to add some food.
Ideas about food up until the First World War were quite different from the ideas we have today. In particular, the worry on the part of a lot of food reformers who thought that Americans were undernourished and worried that especially poor Americans in cities and immigrant populations didn't have enough to buy the adequate amount of nutrition, and that the foods they were choosing weren't nutritious. So candy could sort of position itself as the ideal nutrition food in a certain way because it had a lot of calories. And in those days, calories were really the measure of food value. The more calories it had, the more food value it had. And I mean, you can understand a certain way. We need calories to go. I mean, that's just, you know, you can't live without food, right? But when you have only calories as a measure of how valuable a food is, candy comes out way on top.
Yeah.
And, you know, the candy bar as a kind of portable, dense, inexpensive energy source really comes into its own in the 1920s and 1930s when people are looking for something they can eat on the go, something that's going to give them energy and stamina, something that's going to fit into what is now in the 20s and 30s a much more fast-paced, machine-driven lifestyle. So candy really fit well with the ways that America was reimagining itself as an energetic, on-the-go, active kind of nation.
And you also talk about, both in World War I and World War II, how important it was to the war effort and the diet of the soldiers.
Yeah, I confess before this project, I was never that interested in war history. But it turns out that in World War I and in World War II, the role of candy in military efforts was absolutely central. That, you know, the military provisioners would always put candy in the rations for stamina, for energy, as a morale booster. And the candy industry really worked closely with the military, especially in World War II, to provide vast quantities of candy for military troops who were stationed overseas. In fact, the Baby Ruth manufacturer, Curtis Candy, took out ads saying, "Don't be mad at us if you can't find your favorite candy in the store. We're making all the candy we can, and we're sending it to the boys overseas." So there was really a sense of the patriotic function of candy as supporting the war effort.
And people were asked to use less sugar. You have these wonderful glossy center pieces in your book here of ads from the early part of the 20th century, for the most part.
Yeah.
But one of them was also from the United States Food Administration about not using so much sugar that we have enough to make candy for the troops.
That's right. And some people were annoyed. They're like, "What are you saying, that I can't have sugar for my coffee and my tea, but when I go to the store, I see all kinds of candy. Why does the candy industry get sugar and I don't?" And the candy industry was able to counter by saying, "Well, we're providing a vital war support."
Sure.
You know, candy is part of the war effort. So.
Well, it was kind of surprising, too, what you found, that how much sugar people used.
Well, you know, Americans have had a sweet tooth, and in that day, it was, you know, the sugar in the coffee, the sugar in the tea, the sugar poured over the breakfast cereal, the sugar poured over the grapefruit. You know, everything could taste better with sugar, as we have learned to our, you know, now some of our nutritional woes today are because of too much sugar. So,
well, you have a relatively detailed chronicle of the all kinds of claims of candy sellers and the challenges from critics of candy over the years. I just like to talk about a couple of them. One of the early ones was that it was really a demon candy, an evil substance equivalent to alcohol in some respects. How did that come about?
Well, that was so fascinating to discover. It wasn't only a metaphor, like candy is evil, like alcohol is evil. Many people actually believed that there was a close chemical connection between candy and alcohol, in particular that both of them would be metabolized in the body as a similar way, and that candy was turning to alcohol in the stomach. Some people actually talked about the stomach as a little distillery for candy to turn into liquor. And so there were real debates about whether candy eating going to slake the appetite for alcohol, in which case alcoholics could kick the habit by eating candy, or was candy going to stoke the appetite for alcohol, in which case children toddling down to the little penny candy store and buying those, you know, licorice pipes and candy balls were really taking the first slippery step down the slope to total depravity.
So the candy industry had to respond, and it did, and always has responded to all these challenges over the years. And another one came along at least in the 50s and maybe before, about obesity. We've got it now. I mean, the same thing going on right now.
Sure,
obesity
sure.
Epidemic in the country in the 50s after the war. And then I wrote down the name Lulu Peters. Was that the name of the calorie counter?
Lulu Peters is the writer who introduced Americans to the idea of calorie counting in the 1920s. And she was the first one who took some of the new nutritional ideas about calories and nutrition and translated them into a kind of popular framework for people so that they could sort of know how many calories were in their food and count them. And, opposed to the nutritionists who were saying people aren't eating enough calories, they need to eat more, she's saying you're getting too fat, you need to eat less. And the best way to eat less calories is to cut out the candy completely. And candy, in her writings, was really one of the primary temptations to fatness. And this idea that candy makes you fat, of course, has had a long history, and that's the first thing that anybody thinks when they see somebody eating candy is, uh-oh, that's, you know, fattening. What do you say to that? Well, all food is fattening in principle if you eat too much of it.
Yeah, calories. You just measure the calories, and that tells
exactly.
You, of course.
One of the most fascinating episodes, though, in this whole sort of is candy fattening, is it not candy, is not candy fattening, was, when the candy industry tried to respond to some of the attacks on the idea of sugar as fattening by saying, no, candy can help you with your diet. And they actually published a little pamphlet that was the candy diet, and the idea being that if you nibbled on candy sort of between meals, you would keep your energy up and you wouldn't be tempted to kind of overeat. And so a little bit of candy could actually support your diet and help you lose weight. And there's a beautiful picture of this really chubby woman standing on a scale, and somebody's holding out a box of chocolates and saying, what, candy can help me reduce?
And then on the other side was the tobacco industry and saying that have a Lucky instead of a sweet.
Yeah, reach for a Lucky instead of a sweet. Boy, did that make the candy industry mad. You know, they were like, what? Why don't you just promote your cigarettes and leave us out of it? This was in the 20s.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was a huge controversy because, the American Tobacco Company spent tons and tons of money promoting cigarettes by basically saying candy is fattening and the way to not eat fattening candy is to smoke cigarettes. The candy industry has always been outmatched in all of these kind of PR wars. They never had much money. With the exception of Hershey and Mars today, candy business is, nobody is getting rich. And so when they had these attacks on the candy product, they really didn't have very much to fight back with. And so it was kind of a pathetic mismatch. And you can see from the size of the tobacco industry and the relative size of the candy industry, the tobacco kind of won on that one.
Well, I'm speaking here with Professor Samira Kawash, who's written a book called Candy, A Century of Panic and Pleasure, and discussing how candy evolved from a luxury food to a readily available snack, inexpensive snack food. Now, I've got a million things here I would ask you about, love to ask you about, but we're going to run out of time. Before I get to them, I want to get to now to the present a little bit. And Maybe you explain what you mean by candification of food.
Yeah, well, one of the things that was really interesting to me going back to the beginnings of candy was the way that candy was the first food that was made as wholly artificial. You know, that industrial candy making involved bringing together materials like sugar and other sugar kind of products and flavorings and colorings, and then doing some kind of chemical and engineering magic to them so that what came out resembled nothing ever before seen in nature. Fast forward to the 60s and 70s, and the rest of the food industry starts doing something very similar. You have the emergence of, you know, sugar-sweetened cereals in every color of the rainbow and in every shape you can imagine. You have, you know, the snack bars and the jelly candy, the fruit snacks and the fruit bars and all kinds of things in packages at the grocery store that they don't look like anything your mother made. They don't look like anything that grew on a tree. And I mean, they're the wizardry of food engineering, that has permeated every aspect of our diet. And candy was really there first. Candy kind of invented this way of thinking about food as entirely artificial.
And so, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, not to mention the role of sugar and the way that sugar has become, you know, sort of so central to so many of the foods that we eat. So in my mind, many of these manufactured foods are candy in another guise. You know, they don't go by the name of candy, but they share many, many qualities with candy. And we eat them today the way that candy was eaten in the past. The only problem is today we think of some of these as food, like, you know, energy bars and breakfast cereal and things like that. We think of them as meal food instead of treat food.
Sure. And so there is a blurring of the lines between what is candy and what is food. But you mentioned the excess sugar consumption or the sugar being involved in making candy and a lot of other foods now. And I can tell you we had a cardiologist on last week in an interview talking about the JAMA study that just came out, or it came out in the Journal of American Medical Association about correlation between excess sugar consumption and heart disease. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned it in your book. I mean, you talked about that kind of coming back in, I think he said 2012, it started to be raised again. And you mentioned some English biochemist back in the 70s, I forgot his name now, who warned about the dangers of sugar, too much sugar. And that was kind of poo-pooed. And instead, saturated fat was made the enemy.
Yeah, it was John Yudkin back in the 70s who was the first to really articulate a very coherent attack on sugar. His book was called Pure, White, and Deadly. I mean, I can't top that.
Yeah.
But he was really, you know, drummed out of the profession. And it was, you know, only, you know, the ones who demonized fat were the ones who were on top for the longest time. So, you know, coming around to really examining the effects of sugar on health disease and other chronic disease conditions has only recently become a kind of acceptable biochemistry pursuit. I think that there's some very interesting research out there. I'm not a clinician. I'm just an interpreter of these things. But, it really strikes me that we have this pendulum that swings back and forth, and we're sort of on the other side of the swing now where, you know, people don't want to eat anything that has any sugar in it at all, some people. And I think, you know, we need to find some way to kind of navigate with a little bit in the middle.
And despite all these issues that you raise in your book and explain, we didn't get to talk about cavities and all the other things that sugar is accused of.
400 pages, it's too much.
Yeah, I know. But you come out, ultimately, your final chapter is called Defense of Candy, and you say, what the heck, I still enjoy eating the jelly bean. You say that the National Candy, is that what it is? National
Candy? The Confectioners Association.
Confectioners Association has sort of modified its claims now to be a little more mild about what it claims for candy.
I was surprised to discover this number. Candy is like 6% of the added sugar in the average American diet. I thought the number would be much higher. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, you look at the candy and you're like, oh, well, that's got to be so much of the sugar we're eating. It turns out it's a very small portion. So we are eating too much sugar. We're eating too much sugar for breakfast, lunch, and dinner and in between. And, it's because sugar is in everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been looking a lot at soda, which we're now calling liquid candy, and I think that that's an interesting twist. But we know that soda is a big portion, and sweetened drinks are a big portion of the sugar. But the sugar's in everything else, too. And I think that a lot of the problem is processed food generally, which tends to hide a lot of things like sugar and other processed ingredients so that we don't really recognize them. We recognize candy. We know it's sugar. But, you know, what is in that pot pie that you're eating? Oh, there's sugar in there, too. And I think that, you know, starting to think more carefully about what's in the processed food, and if sugar is the problem that we're beginning to recognize it as being, we need to be thinking about the role of sugar all across the board and not just in the candies and the sodas.
Exactly. And that's what I found most interesting about your book is that it's way beyond what candy's role in our diet and really, really discusses all food and particularly processed food. And I want to tell people where they can get more information on this and where they can buy your book. And maybe, obviously, I'm going to say candyprofessor.com.
Yeah, I have a website. It's candyprofessor.com, and some of the, you know, I have the little candy stories are there. It's a fun place to poke around. The book is Candy, A Century of Panic and Pleasure, and it's out. It's available from your local bookseller. It's available from the major online booksellers, which don't need me to promote them. So,
right.
You know, anywhere you can buy a book, you can buy my book. Just search for Candy, Panic and Pleasure, and it will pop right up, and I hope your listeners will enjoy reading it.
Well, thank you very much. Is there anything you want to add before we sign off here?
Well, I have to say that, you know, your region of the country is one of the heartlands of American candy. It's you know, it's where some fine candies have been made and where people love their candy. So enjoy.
Nut goodies.
That's right.
Okay, thank you very much, Samira Kawash.
All right.